This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. In your health today, milk and honey. We look at why some folks are convinced that raw milk is better than pasteurized. First, though, a resurgence in backyard beekeeping. It's teaching urbanites about the huge role bees play in sustaining our nation's food supply. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports.
Just outside Cleveland, in the town of Medina, Ohio, there's been a big shift in who's signing up for beekeeping classes. There were twice as many students this year compared to last. And who are these new beekeepers? Well, lots of them are women.
The surge has really been with younger urban women. And 20 years ago, nobody would have guessed that.
Kim Flottam has been teaching beekeeping for years, and he says this seems to be the trend. Nationwide, there are roughly 100,000 backyard beekeepers. Subscriptions to the publication Bee Culture are on the rise. And when he published a how-to book aimed at making beekeeping easier with more lightweight equipment, 60,000 people snapped up copies.
I know how I feel when I take my honey out of my beehives. I feel really excited. I mean, I tell everybody. I post it on my Facebook.
Jen Sass is one of these women at the top of the new beekeeping bell curve. As she walks me out to her two hives that sit along the fence of her small backyard just outside Washington, D.C., I ask her why she thinks people are so gaga for bees.
I think there's a real sort of revival of an interest in rural type things. I think also it's something...
Even if there are urban horns in the background.
Yeah, we're very urban here.
And also very into the local food movement. So even if space is at a premium, the beauty of bees is that they can pollinate flowers and plants and yards all over her neighborhood. As she lifts off the cover of one of her hives, she says she loves to watch the bees at work.
What I'm trying to discover is how productive my bees have been.
Looks like there's plenty of honey, so that's good. But there's also a bunch of bees loafing at the bottom of the hive. These are the male bees, the drones. Their sole purpose is to fertilize the queen, and now that they've done it, they're just hanging out. So the queen is about ready to kick them out. She gives this job to her female worker bees.
They kind of peck and bother them and kind of chase them out, unfortunately. It's a cold winter if you're a drone.
It's really cutthroat, the hive. If you're a slacker, you're out. And this has served the honeybee species well over the millennia. But Sass says there's a big problem for bees these days. Despite all the urban enthusiasm, turns out that honeybee populations are way down. There's a syndrome called colony collapse disorder, where whole hives suddenly perish.
We've lost 40% of our bee colonies in the last 10 years. So it's really a mystery what's happening.
Now, if the only thing bees did was to make honey, maybe this wouldn't be a big deal. But bees are hugely important to our food supply. Jen Sass, who also happens to be a scientist with the Natural Resources Defense Council, explains bees pollinate billions of dollars worth of fruits and vegetables every year. And I'm willing to bet any of you out there listening now that before this day is over, you'll have eaten something, maybe an apple, a cucumber, some blueberries or almonds, that could not have been grown without the bees. So how does this all work? Well, let me introduce you to commercial beekeeper Dave Hackenberg. He drives his beehives all over the country, from cranberry bogs in New England to almond groves in California, so they can pollinate these crops. We reached him in his truck en route to another delivery.
We're actually in Tamaqua, Pennsylvania. Just got done delivering bees to pumpkins.
Yep, he said pumpkins. Now, no one's thinking about jack-o'-lanterns or pumpkin pie in July, but this is prime growing season. And without bees in the field to pollinate, the pumpkins just wouldn't grow right. They'd be lopsided or really small, and the farmer wouldn't get enough pumpkins to make it worth his time. So you can see why farmers need bees. But Dave Hackenberg says it's getting tougher for commercial beekeepers like him to make a good living. He's lost a bunch of hives to this colony collapse phenomenon.
When you're losing thousands of them and you got to replace them on a yearly basis, then you're probably going to go out of business.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture is trying to prevent this. They're handing out some $6 million in emergency assistance this summer to beekeepers who've lost their hives. And meanwhile, scientists are still trying to figure out what's causing bee colony collapse. The latest thinking is that some combination of viruses, mites, pesticides, and climate change may be weakening the immune system of bees. For now, there's plenty of honey to go around, thanks in part to the enthusiasm of urban pioneers like Jen Sass.
for sure there is a food revolution, and the revolution is to stay local and be more excited about, you know, what you can put on the table from, you know, within 50 feet of your house.
And if you've ever wondered whether the liquid gold really has healing powers, well, you can find out the answer in my web show, Tiny Desk Kitchen, on NPR.org. I'm Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
If you are desperate to escape the heat that's now blanketing the U.S., we have a tourist destination for you, Gusev Crater on Mars. It's winter there. But if you go, you won't be alone. You'll also find NASA's robotic rover called Spirit. It landed in Gusev Crater 6.5 years ago, and since then, it's been snapping pictures and exploring the red planet's watery past until recently. Now, the rover is silent. It's in a kind of hibernation mode in order to survive the Martian winter. Almost every instrument, including the communication radio, is shut down. NPR's Joe Palca recently visited the rover control room at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, and he has this report.
Winter is always a tough time for a solar-powered outpost on Mars. Days are short, the sun is low on the horizon, and it's cold. Really cold. More than 60 degrees below zero.
And that's colder than the rover has ever been on Mars.
John Callis is mission manager for NASA's rover program.
Now, the rover was tested to that temperature here on the ground, but that was 7 years ago with a brand new rover. This is a rover that's quite senior.
And this was a mission that was intended to last 90 days, not 7 years. In previous winters, the rover used battery-powered heaters to keep warm. But this year, those heaters are shut off to save energy. Two reasons for that. One, the rover's been stuck in the sand for more than a year with its solar panels not pointing in the best direction. And two, those solar panels are covered with Martian dust, so they're not as efficient at recharging the rover's batteries. That's why engineers let Spirit enter a deep sleep mode for the winter.
When Spirit will wake up is very uncertain right now.
It will only wake up when the days get longer and the solar panels are able to recharge the batteries. Callis says they've made a computer model to predict when that will be.
That model predicts that the rover might wake up sometime around the late September, early October timeframe.
But Callis says the model's calculations are based on several assumptions, so it may not be very accurate.
The rover could wake up tomorrow if temperatures are warmer than we expected. That's why we've been listening every day. We have been listening every day for some time now.
If it does wake up, its roving days are likely over. Two of its six motorized wheels have stopped working, and mission managers are not optimistic about getting it rolling again. But Callis says if Spirit does wake up, it still makes a great weather station and can help with experiments designed to understand the planet's core. On the other side of Mars, Spirit's twin rover Opportunity is in much better shape. It also uses solar arrays for power, and it also has a lot of dust on those arrays. But every once in a while, Opportunity gets lucky.
Recently, we had a cleaning event on Opportunity. Part of the dust on the solar arrays was blown off by some sort of a wind event. And now we have a lot more power, and we can drive almost every day at this point.
Opportunity is on its way to a large crater called Endeavour. Scientists hope to find very old rock formations there. Opportunity started its 12-mile trek to the crater 2 years ago, and it's about halfway there.
As we get closer to Martian summer, we should be able to drive longer and longer each day.
Some of the instruments on Opportunity are showing signs of age, but Callis won't make any predictions about when its mission will end. Why should he?
We're going to keep going until the rover stops.
And at least for now, that day still seems a long way off. Joe Palca, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered.
Our critic at large, John Powers, has been thinking about two currently popular heroines, Bella from the Twilight series and Lisbeth from Stieg Larsson's Millennium trilogy. John says these heroines have more in common than you might think.
If you look at the most successful pop franchises over the last 50 years, from James Bond to Star Wars to Harry Potter, one thing is obvious. They're dominated by men. Which makes it all the more remarkable that right now there are two cultural juggernauts centering on women. The Twilight series, created by Stephanie Meyer, and Stieg Larsson's Millennium trilogy, featuring the girl with the dragon tattoo. Together, the novels have sold tens of millions of copies, while the screen adaptations are raking in dollars by the hundreds of millions. To be honest, neither Meyer nor Larson are great writers, but their legions of fans don't care. That's because Twilight and Millennium offer something they like better than literary merit, primal fantasies. And what's interesting is that these two fantasies are almost diametrically opposed, not least in their image of women. As a young adult series embraced by millions of grown-ups, Twilight offers a fantasy of perfect love that's pure adolescent romanticism. Its heroine, Bella, is a high school girl who falls for a handsome vampire, Edward Cullen, and wants to sleep with him. But the old-school Edward won't do it, or turn her into a vampire, unless Bella marries him first. At the same time, Bella's pursued by Jacob Black, a hunk who just happens to be a werewolf. Sadly, he doesn't have a prayer. You see, Jacob's from a Native American family without much money, while the Cullens live in a fancy house and have an aristocratic air. While all this may sound rather wild, the whole thing is in fact strikingly square. Things stay at a level of innocence startling for a present-day vampire story. Here, for example, Bella and her father have to stop Edward from fighting with Jacob.
Edward?
If you ever touch her against her will again...
Don't do this!
She's not sure what she wants.
Don't do this!
Let me give you a clue.
Wait for her to say the words.
Fine.
And she will.
Jacob, just go, okay?
Hey. Easy, guys. Easy. Let's take it down a notch. All right? What's going on? I kissed Bella.
True Blood, this isn't. Turning on kisses, not nudity, the series offers a vision of love that could hardly be more conservative. From beginning to end, the supposed outsider Bella is defined by her romantic yearnings. Love for a man so strong that she'll turn into a vampire to be with him. By series end, such a love has entailed staying a virgin, then getting married out of high school, and then instantly having babies. A friend, whose 10-year-old daughter adores Twilight, says he's horrified that she might think Bella is somehow a role model. On the face of it, he'd be happier with the values of the Millennium trilogy. It offers not a conservative fantasy of romance, but a liberal fantasy of perfect justice. Where Twilight creates a reality in which the social world barely appears, stories like The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo take place in a contemporary world overrun with rapists, serial killers, and corporate bigwigs who are essentially gangsters. Basically, two people stand up against all this. One is middle-aged Michael Blomqvist, a rumpled, womanizing left-wing journalist who's pretty clearly Larson's romanticized projection of himself. But the series' real selling point is its title heroine, Lisbeth Salander, an extraordinarily vivid pop creation. Abused as a child, Salander has grown up to be tattooed, pierced, bisexual, and aggressively antisocial. Both a ferocious fighter and a genius computer hacker, Salander is defined by no man. Instead, she pointedly takes down men who are violent against women. But to be an unstoppable vessel of justice, she has to cut herself off from all normal emotion and from everyone else, even those who care about her. So far, so good. Yet Millennium's sense of social justice reveals a dark side to liberal righteousness. These are vigilante tales, structured to fill us with such rage that we can't wait for Salander to exact her vengeance. When I recently saw the current episode, The Girl Who Played with Fire, the guy in front of me applauded when Salander took an axe to a baddie. And this was at a screening for a public radio station. All this makes Millennium so different from Twilight that it may seem incredible they're both popular at the same time. Yet the strength of both series lies in something their heroines do have in common, an absolute willingness to go the distance. Say what you will against them, Bella and Salander are not the silly shop-till-they-drop mediocrities celebrated in chick-lit comedies. They are mythically passionate souls who will do what it takes, even give up their humanity, in order to achieve perfection. 007 and Luke Skywalker couldn't do any better than that.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. You can read David Edelstein's reviews of the films John mentioned on our website, freshair.npr.org.
One of the unemployed workers flanking the president as he called for extending jobless benefits used to work at an auto dealership. But a new watchdog report says the Obama administration may have jeopardized tens of thousands of auto dealer jobs when it pressed Chrysler and General Motors to quickly shed more than 2,000 dealerships last year. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
There was little question last year that GM and Chrysler had more dealers than they needed. Both companies planned to eliminate some of them gradually. But the Special Inspector General, monitoring the government's bailout program, says the Obama administration wanted to cut more dealers more quickly as a condition of rescuing the automakers. That was bad news for Russell Whatley, a third-generation Chrysler dealer in Mineral Wells, Texas.
We were given 3 weeks to shut down operations, and it is pretty well threw everybody for a loop.
The inspector general now suggests that haste may have backfired, potentially costing tens of thousands of jobs at shuttered dealerships without necessarily saving big money for the automakers. Analyst Michael Robinette of IHS Automotive says some of the dealers that closed were in underserved rural areas, not in the big cities.
There's no doubt that in hindsight, the government would certainly look to slow down the rate of dealer reductions as well as the criteria they use to implement them.
After Congress ordered arbitration, GM and Chrysler offered to reinstate about a third of the dealers. Whatley wasn't one of them. He's now trying to hold on by selling used cars, but he says it hasn't been easy.
We've obviously had to cut back on things like Little League sponsorships and high school sponsorships and things like that, but we've not cut our employees. We're just not going to do that.
The Obama administration defends its push for more rapid dealer downsizing. Meanwhile, the Ford Motor Company, which didn't get a government bailout, is closing some of its dealerships, but at a much slower rate. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
It took a few million years for our ancestors to evolve into the walking, talking, texting, and blogging creatures we've become. Along the way, the human body and brain have changed a lot. In our series on evolution, The Human Edge, NPR is taking a look at those changes, in particular, the ones that made us the dominant species. As NPR's Christopher Joyce explains, we couldn't have done it without our feet.
Beautiful shot.
Brian Richmond is a kid's soccer coach. He's also a physical anthropologist. As far as he's concerned, soccer is not just the world's most popular sport. It's the one that might just be best suited to our uniquely human strength.
It would be difficult to play soccer without a foot that's constructed like ours. I suppose if we had the foot of a chimpanzee, you could pick up the ball, you know, and you could throw it.
But we don't have a chimp's foot. A chimp's foot is flexible, built for grasping branches and climbing trees, like our own earliest ancestors. Our foot is stiff, taut, and springy, built for walking and running. And Richmond wants to know, how did we go from a climber's foot to this amazing human appendage? At his office at George Washington University in Washington, D.C., Richmond shows me a photograph.
These footprints are the earliest footprints of early humans.
1.5 million years ago, one of our ancestors left those prints in the African mud. The feet were about size 9. Richmond discovered a whole trackway of these prints. They look like the diagrams of feet that dance instructors use to show how to do the salsa or the tango. For me, and I suspect for Richmond, the prints are even more exciting to behold than a bone or a skull that old, because you can just imagine an ancient action, a living moment captured.
A fossilized footprint is basically fossilized behavior. It shows you what that individual did 1.5 million years ago at that instant in time.
And what do those prints tell Richmond?
Sure enough, they were walking with a long stride. They had an arch in the foot, the way we have.
Long legs and an arch in our foot. Our primate cousins, gorillas, chimps, bonobos, they're flat-footed, no arch. The arch is actually the manifestation of a very complex apparatus inside our foot, an apparatus for walking like no other in the world.
Okay. There we go. We're heading into the gross anatomy lab where we have human cadavers for dissection.
Blue-gloved and white-coated, Richmond leads the way into a brightly lit room at the George Washington University Medical School. Metal gurneys are lined up in neat rows, each covered with a steel lid.
I look at the human body and see how it's put together from a functional perspective and an evolutionary perspective. I see how it's different from other primates.
Richmond lifts a steel cover. Underneath, a cadaver lies, pale and heavy, the head shrouded in gauze. In death, these donated bodies are instruments of learning. Richmond lifts a flap of skin, the sole of the foot, with a metal probe.
So here I've just pulled the skin back, and here you can see one of those characteristics that's really uniquely human, and that is the long tendon that runs from the heel forward underneath the skin all the way to the base of the toes.
It's called the plantar aponeurosis. It's a flat, broad tendon, whitish and taut. Along with spring ligaments, it gives the foot its arch and its stiffness. Imagine thick rubber bands stretching from your toes to your heel. Step down and...
they absorb energy going into your step.
Then at the end of your step...
they actually recoil, bounce back, and help propel your foot.
We've also got short toes and a big toe that's in line with the other toes. These all make for better walking and running and surviving on the ground rather than in the trees. Now, the Kenyan prince did seem to show an arched foot, but Richmond also wants to know how the owners of these feet walked, their posture, their stride, even the angle of their leg bones. He wants to figure out what kind of movement makes that kind of footprint.
So that when we have a footprint, we can work backwards and reconstruct what the steps were like in that individual, even at 1.5 million years ago.
Hi.
This is where graduate student Calista Bernal comes in. Richmond is filming her walking in sand and comparing her footprints to the Kenyan ones.
I'm standing here while they're trying to put these reflective markers on my joints.
She's in a GW lab getting ready to walk the walk.
Can I wear a toe ring?
No toe rings, just tights and a dozen or so reflective markers stuck to her hips, her legs, and her bare feet. She's going to walk through a sandbox. As she walks, cameras focused on those markers will produce a sort of stick-figure computer animation of her gait, the turn of her ankles, the angle of her thighs, even the curl of her toes.
Each footprint that I make, we're going to do 3D scans and try and figure out, based upon how I move and in what type of sediment I step in, how my footprints change. Pretty much as soon as he hits the start button, I start walking.
Yep. Let's do our experiments. Calista, when you're ready...
Bernal strolls through the sand as casually as she can under the watchful eyes of several researchers and a row of cameras.
Good. We got the full left and right. It's a better coverage than I thought it was.
She leaves a nice set of prints in the sand. Richmond measures them with a laser and photographs them. This work is painstaking and a bit seat of the pants. Richmond's not sure what to look for. He's got a snapshot, the footprints. He hopes they'll provide clues to how walking evolved over millions of years, from primitive ancestors to us. The prints he found in Kenya were probably made by Homo erectus. Erectus emerged about 1.8 million years ago. They made tools, hunted, used fire, were taller, and had a bigger brain than their predecessors.
They were starting to change their way of life, where they would go much farther, and a lot of people think it's mainly in terms of finding meat. And meat became a new important part of the diet. That also led eventually to us populating the world more.
The foot, ultimately, is the thing that connects us to our planet. It gave early humans an advantage in an unforgiving world. They didn't have to swing to the next tree. They could just walk. They could run and hunt better. When the climate changed, they could migrate. And eventually, they did, laying down their footprints everywhere. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Here we go, here we go.
Come on.
You put your right foot in, you put your right foot out, you put your right foot in and you shake it all about. You do the hokey pokey and you turn yourself around. That's what it's all about.
Not only did our ancestors walk, they also ran. And on All Things Considered this afternoon, you can hear why some scientists think that running gave us the human edge.
Put your left foot in and you shake it. You do the hokey pokey and you turn yourself around. That's what it's all about. That's
right.
And now we're going to hear about raw milk, the milk that comes straight from the cow. It's illegal to sell in many states, but some people find a way to buy it because they think raw milk is better for them. NPR's April Fulton has this story.
It's 3 o'clock in the afternoon on a sweltering summer day in Bowie, Maryland, and the Reitzig kids are ready for their snack.
Good job, buddy.
That's stay-at-home mom Liz Reitzig. She helps her youngest son, Duncan, who's almost two, pour the milk into his bowl of freshly sliced peaches. But Duncan's milk is practically contraband because it's illegal to sell raw milk in Maryland. Raw milk isn't pasteurized, and it's hard to get. The stuff you buy at the store is usually pasteurized, which means it's superheated to kill harmful germs. But there are some people willing to take that risk with raw milk, and they're very vocal. Mom Liz Reitzig is one of them.
I just think it's so silly. I can go out and get a six-pack of beer anywhere and a carton of cigarettes.
She says the family started drinking raw milk about 6 years ago after her second child was born. Reitzig rolls her eyes thinking about how she has to drive 2 hours or more every week to Pennsylvania to buy it.
Legally, I can feed my children fast food 3 meals a day, but then to get this incredible nutrient-dense, fresh, local food, the farmer in my state is criminalized for selling that to me.
But there's a good reason for that, according to health officials.
Raw milk is associated with significant human illness and potentially with microbes that are deadly.
David Acheson used to head the Food Safety Division at the Food and Drug Administration. He says the Reitzigs are taking a big risk, especially if bacteria hiding in the cow's fecal matter gets in the raw milk. That bacteria would almost certainly be killed if the milk was pasteurized. Bacteria like the one made infamous for recently hiding in spinach and ground beef and cookie dough. E. coli 0157H7.
That's the one that I worry about because we know from clinical experience that can very readily land you in hospital with kidney failure and is potentially deadly.
But Mom Liz Reitzig says if you're gonna eat, you're gonna take some risks. Any food can spoil or become contaminated. Reitzig and others who buy raw milk say drinking it is part of their philosophy. Eating more local and natural foods is healthier. They say it clears up allergies and helps with milk intolerance. But Acheson doesn't buy it.
You know, a lot of that is anecdotal. I have never been convinced by any science that that's the case.
But he does admit that pasteurization kills some nutrients in milk.
You are going to impact vitamins. You are going to do other things to it. But in the grand scheme of things, of a complete healthy diet, it is frankly, in my opinion, irrelevant.
The food safety expert says not getting sick is what's important. He would never drink raw milk. But he thinks banning it only encourages Liz Reitzig and others to skirt the law, and that could put them at greater risk. If you're one of the 1 to 3% of the population that drinks raw milk, Acheson says, make sure that the cows are clean, your hands are clean, and the bottles are sterilized and stored properly. April Fulton, NPR News, Washington.
And there's more on pasteurizing milk and beer at our website, npr.org.